I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, earlier I was talking about Chiang Kai-shek and the strategic position that he found himself in 1937 with the gradual further encroachment of Japan into northern China and the threat to the nationalist government of possibly losing Beijing, and the danger of missing the opportunity to actually commence hostilities with Japan. Chiang was certain that a point would have to come where war was inevitable with Japan. But if you missed that opportunity, then the one would be placed in an almost untenable strategic position. If Beijing, or Beiping at the time as it was called, fell, that would lose all of northern China and create the possibility of a massive Japanese advance into central China, where the nationalists dominated. So picking the moment to call it and to call the opportunity for conflict is really, really crucial. And Chiang decides to do this when there is skirmishes over the Marco Polo Bridge near Beijing. So in the previous podcast, we learned that this was going to be a hugely risky venture for Chiang. There would be virtually no international assistance whatsoever, where the Western democracies had no appetite for war with Japan. The League of Nations was utterly compromised, and America was locked in the midst of its own internal crises with the Great Depression, and the international climate was showing that autocrats and authoritarians and dictators were setting the weather in Spain, in Abyssinia, with Hitler's overthrow of the provisions of the Treaty of Versailles, and the ongoing horrors of terror in the Soviet Union. Chiang was not militarily ready to fight Japan, and believed that there was a core of modernization within the Kuomintang army, which had been assisted by German officers Siegt and von Falkenhausen, who had acted as military advisors. But this is not gone far enough, and it's not big enough. So, Rana Mitter writes again. Instead, much of Chang's strategy would have to rely on troops provided by his supposed subordinates. He not only had to address how useful such troops would actually be, but also how many commanders would in fact be loyal to him. Song Jiehuan had extensive contacts with the Japanese and seemed to miss no opportunity to bolster his own position at the expense of Chiang's. Song was a Chinese warlord. The nature of China at the time was that significant parts of the territory are controlled by warlords who are often loyal to the Kuomintang government, but sometimes not. And so having part of the manpower reserves that the Kuomintang government called upon came from warlords. And so you had to really make sure that these guys were on side. And often, if you went to them cap in hand, they could take the opportunity to extract concessions and enhance their own power at the expense of Chiang Kai-shek. Yan Zhishan, who led the major inland province of Shaanxi, had been known as a progressive warlord, but he had also been in part of an anti-Chiang alliance during the 1930s Northern Plains Civil War and had played the communists and Japanese off against the nationalists in the years leading up to 1937. The alliance with the communists was also very fragile. Despite the official message of cooperation, neither side truly trusted the other, and the memories of the debacle at Xi'an were still powerful on both sides. The unappetizing menu left Chiang with a stark choice. Either he acknowledged that northern China was lost, or he fought back. But by fighting, the war would undoubtedly expand from a local conflict to an all-out confrontation between the two powers. Chiang didn't have the time to deal with the numerous problems that China had. China was facing facing internal breakup and colonization by Japan, which would, in the minds of many Chinese, and quite reasonably, be seen as part of an ongoing process of colonization that China had experienced since the 1840s. China hadn't been able to modernize in the ways that Japan had. There's a very interesting thesis on this subject put forward by Donald Sassoon that suggested essentially that Japan, having been run by a samurai class in the 1860s, that was dedicated to militarization in the defense of the nation, and China being having in the 19th century having been run by a largely self-serving Mandarin class that was interested in preserving their own power, this fact resulted in a very efficient modernization in Japan and a very sluggish and ultimately failed attempts at modernization in China. So by the way, that's from The Anxious Triumph by Donald Sassoon, which is just a stunning, stunning book, which if you want to look at the origins of the 19th century origins of global capitalism, get that book. It's truly, truly amazing. So Japan had time on its side and China didn't. Rana Mitter writes, China did not, as Chiang would have wished, have sufficient time to professionalise more of its military, neutralise the separatist tendencies of its military leaders, and strengthen the economic and fiscal base of the country. And the scale of preparation for war in Japan by 1937 made Chinese efforts look minor indeed. During the attempted coup of February 1936, Japan's finance minister Takahashi Korekiyo had been assassinated. A consequence of his death was a major increase in military spending. Japan's government and public were both increasingly fueled by a desire to teach China a lesson, and regarded its increasing unification with a growing sense of nationalism with alarm. There's this strange kind of dual attitude towards China, in Japan, as the China is seen as the kind of the impudent upstart that needs to be taught some hard lessons in modernization, but also there is this sense of entitlement to Chinese territory in Japan. This idea that really big swathes of China do belong to Japan, and Japan has proved itself worthy in almost a kind of slightly Darwinistic way of growth at China's expense. It's this mighty martial people that have learned the tricks of the West should be given the opportunity to grow in and should be shown respect by China as the kind of the hegemonic power in Asia. But at the same time, there's something to be feared about China. If China does get its act together, and China modernizes and industrializes and militarizes in the right way, then there'll be no stopping her. Unlike in Nazi Germany or fascist Italy, there was no single figure in Japan, no Duce or Führer, whose personal megalomania lay at the heart of foreign policy. Instead, Japan had ended up with a toxic situation where most of its politicians, military and public, had become infected by war fever. Military spending now took up nearly half of Japan's total budget. Furthermore, recovery from the Depression was fueled in part by growth in heavy industry, much of which made products that would be useful to any future war effort. At home, the media publicised the idea that Japan was being surrounded by hostile powers who wished to prevent its rise. In 1934, the Tokyo government abrogated the 1930 London Naval Treaty, which was supposed to restrain the size of Japan's navy in comparison with those of the USA and the British Empire. Now, nothing but budget would prevent Japan expanding its naval capacities. In June 1937, some 6 years of Japanese policymakers blowing hot and cold towards China, a new man was appointed as Prime Minister. It fell to Prince Konoe Fumimaro to decide how to respond to the Marco Polo Bridge incident. Now, I've talked about Prince Konoe before, when I did Eri Hotter's brilliant book about the year between or the years between the outbreak of war in Europe and Pearl Harbor. Konoe is a pivotal figure in that. It's a very interesting, quite difficult to read character, who would later go on to be a pivotal figure in Japan's militaristic crimes. However, one who was kind of Teflon enough to try to get out of most of the reckoning. Konoe was an aristocratic civilian with abundant diplomatic experience. He had attended the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 and come away from it convinced that the nations of Asia would never receive a just settlement from the Western powers. Konoe came from one of the noblest families in Japan, so close to the emperor that he even spoke in the rather stilted language that was reserved for the royal family and a few close courtiers. He was a cultured man who had translated works by Oscar Wilde in his youth and had an aristocratic temperament. He rarely held meetings before 11 o'clock in the morning, a stark contrast to Chang, whose military training and natural asceticism meant that he regularly rose at 5 a.m. Yet Konoe was also a weak man, unable to stand up to those who opposed him. His secretary called him as a Hamlet-like and lonely. The aristocratic veteran politician, Prince Seonji Kimochi, declared that Konoe lacked the one thing needed in dealing with the army: strength. So here we're going to encounter some difficulties or in the relationship between the political class and the, not just the army, but the Kuomintang army in China. The Kuomintang army, quite literally, by 1937, is a law unto itself in Manchuria, and makes policy decisions independent of the political class in China, in Japan, which in some ways politicians like Konoe interpreted and saw that there was no choice ultimately than to go along with an army that was be out of control anyway. Konoe's first test on the China question came just a month after his appointment. He found his cabinet split on the matter of how to respond to the Marco Polo Bridge incident. The senior general staff officer, Muto Akira, and the chief of military affairs of the military affairs department of the Ministry of War, Tanaka Shinchi.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Advocated an escalation of hostilities. Now is the time to strike hard at China and destroy Chiang Kai-shek's regime. Ishiwara Kanji, who headed the operations division of the general staff, was much more cautious. This was ironic, as Ishiwara had been the mastermind behind the invasion of Manchuria, but had now argued that Japan was not ready for war with China, and that opening a war with the Nanjing government might even make Japan more vulnerable to the USSR. One should not exaggerate the difference between the two sides. Even moderates in the Japanese government believed that China should ultimately come under Japanese influence, but they disagreed on the timing. So this is a key distinction here, that there weren't factions within the Japanese government that thought that a kind of a peaceful, liberal approach to China was in any way appropriate. It was just a question of when we do it. And what the timing was. And you find around the world, in Tokyo, in Berlin, in Moscow and London, regimes obsessed with timing, with looking at different scenarios for war and conflict, different scenarios, different timescales. This is the time period of Hitler's famous Hossbach memorandum, looking at different cases for war and when things could ideally happen, and what the ideal circumstances are. And this is similar. And the idea that one course of action might be leave Japan more vulnerable than another. On the 9th of July, Sugiyama again, the Minister of War, known as the Toilet Door because it was said by his colleagues that one could push him in any direction, like the door in a Japanese laboratory store, asked for five divisions to be mobilised for deployment in North China. The request was denied, but only for the moment. Back at the Marco Polo Bridge, the local Chinese and Japanese commanders were beginning to discuss a ceasefire. The Shanghai press was still trying to determine who was responsible for the incident. Who started the firing is still not clear, the North China Daily News of the 10th of July declared, but it is considered probable that the Chinese, guarding the railway bridgehead, seeing an armed party advancing along an embankment in the dark, challenged them and, on receiving no reply, opened fire, thinking them to be plainclothes men or Japanese staging a real attack. But by now, the fate of the bridge near Beijing was beside the point. The leaders of both China and Japan were seeing the events through a much wider lens. On the 10th of July, Chiang noted, "The Japanese have already attacked at Lugaochao, but their goals don't stop there." Lugaochao, by the way, is the Marco Polo Bridge. "We've already sent troops north. Perhaps we can restrain their ambitions," he went on. "If we don't show preparation and determination, we can't resolve this peacefully." So, in some ways, the preparation to fight was a way of actually deterring further Japanese attacks, deterring further Japanese encroachments upon the upon China. But also, it was something that was almost guaranteed to escalate the situation. On the July 11th, an American diplomat met He Ying-Chin, Chiang's Minister of War, and asked him whether the confrontation at Lugaochao meant war. He Ying-Chin replied that it was up to the Japanese and that if they continued their bandit methods, then war would be inevitable. Peck put it to He, this is the American diplomat, that even at a sacrifice, it was worth postponing war for a couple of years to strengthen preparations. But He was firm. It would be hard to know exactly when China would be truly ready. And if they were attacked, then they would fight. So there were plenty of voices from within Chiang's government that also urged caution. Chiang's biggest rival for power, Wang Jingwei, who would eventually collaborate with the Japanese, had spent most of the 1930s trying to de-escalate with Japan. Now, writes Ranamita, he advised Chiang not to escalate the conflict. Another voice advocating patience belonged to Zhu Fohai. In 1937, Zhu was the deputy director of propaganda for the Nationalists, but he had taken the tortuous path to get there. As a young man, Zhu had been a founding member of the Chinese Communist Party, but had swiftly left it to join the Nationalists. Even so, he retained friendships with prominent communists. When one of the party's founders, Chen Duzhu, was released from prison in August 1937, Zhu was one of the first visitors. However, during the Nanjing decade, his politics drifted more closely toward Wang Jingwei's. Within a few months, their association would have huge consequences for both men. In the days after fighting broke out on the 7th of July, Zhu was on his way to join Chiang at Lushan. On arrival, he wrote in his diary, "I fear that an external issue will evolve into a domestic issue, which makes it harder for the central government to deal with. I'm disappointed." Even as he took in the atmosphere at Lushan, Zhu continued to hope that matters would be settled peacefully. The mood was convivial as he attended the banquet given jointly by Chiang and Wang. Even though resistance was discussed at the meeting on the 17th of July, there did not seem to be desire for war. About 7 people spoke, Zhu noted, but none of them was impressive. The next day, he wrote that he had heard that the Japanese ambassador to China, Kawago Shigeru, had been in contact with the Chinese foreign minister to try to calm the situation down and frame the conflict as a regional matter. Based on this, Zhu wrote about with a sense of hope, I reckon the incident won't expand. So in this moment between the incident at the bridge and the actual full outbreak of war between China and Japan, there were still individuals on both sides who didn't have a kind of deterministic role or view of events, who didn't see war as inevitable, who didn't see war as necessarily desirable, and who thought that diplomacy and de-escalation was possible. And this is the interesting thing for us as history students, that there are these moments in the prelude to wars where there are still individuals, not individuals without consequence either, who look to de-escalate. And it's very easy for us to, knowing what happened, see what actually happened as the inevitable outcome, and it rarely is. So we'll continue more with the build-up to China's to Chiang's war with Japan in the third part of this little series, and hopefully we'll get some of that down later in the week. Coming up later this week, by the way, I've got Sean McMeekin's new history of Stalin's war, which is a really interesting new perspective a different perspective on our standard tropes about the Second World War. Okay, let's finish there. Thanks so much for listening, and you can always check us out at explaininghistory.org. And you can check out our Patreon there. It's always great if we can have patrons to back the podcast. It helps me to continue to put out really cool content like this. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.